Headlines: the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocide leaves a bloody trail of civilian death and destruction in the Gaza Strip, with overall fatalities now nearing 20,700. The Iraqi government slams the U.S. strike on the country's anti-terror popular mobilization forces in south of Baghdad. Israel assassinates a senior Iranian military advisor in Syria, reaction to his failure to counter the resistance group operations. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians are seeing no respite from Israeli onslaught on Gaza, as airstrikes and shelling have become a regular occurrence. In the southern strip, people wake up to another day of bloodshed, mourning the loss of their loved ones. In the past 24 hours, some 250 Palestinians have been killed across Gaza. Some Israeli strikes targeted an area in the vicinity of Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis, claiming the lives of several people. Israeli warplanes also bombed a residential building in a refugee camp in the city of Rafah, located in the south. The bombardment left two people dead and several more injured. The attack was carried out while the area is hosting Palestinians displaced from the north and central Gaza. Those who witnessed the strikes say that Israel has once again proven that no place is safe from the regime's bombing campaign on the Palestinian territory.
Israel claims that there are safe residential areas or secure zones, but this attack contradicts its allegations and lies. The refugee camp and the Al-Shabura camp are home to tens of thousands of peaceful citizens, so there is no safe place for anyone in the Gaza Strip.
Other areas in Gaza have been the scene of new Israeli strikes as well. They include several refugee camps in central Gaza. Israel's genocidal war is now in its 81st day. The total death toll since October the 7th is nearing 20,700. Tens of thousands of others have been injured, most of the casualties, women and children. The former Israeli chief of staff, as it says there, Dan Halutz, said that we have lost the war against Hamas. Again, the former Israeli chief of staff, Dan Halutz, saying that Israel has lost the war against Hamas. It appears that's all we have on this. Obviously, we'll make sure to give you more details once we get it. Well, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has lashed out at the Israeli premier after he expressed support for the displacement of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to other countries. The ministry said Benjamin Netanyahu's plan, which he calls the voluntary migration of Palestinians from Gaza, reveals the true goals of the regime's genocidal war. Added that the crime of ethnic cleansing and displacement must stop before it's too late. Hamas also rejected the Israeli Prime Minister's plan for displacing Gazans as ridiculous. The resistance movement said Netanyahu's move is an excuse to prolong the regime's onslaught on Gaza. Hamas added that it will not allow Israel to obliterate the Palestinian cause or to remove Palestinians from their land. The Israeli military reports the killing of two more soldiers in southern Gaza as fierce fighting continues across the besieged territory. The regime's military also said that three of its soldiers were also injured in the fighting in southern and northern Gaza. Around 160 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the regime launched its ground invasion of Gaza some 2 months ago. However, the Hamas resistance movement says that fatalities among invading troops are much higher. On Monday, Hamas leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, said Palestinian resistance fighters have inflicted heavy losses on the Israeli military in the ongoing battle in Gaza. According to Sinwar, some 5,000 Israeli forces have been killed or injured, and more than 750 military vehicles have been damaged or destroyed. The Israeli regime continues to kill Palestinian journalists in Gaza on an almost daily basis. Israeli forces have killed scores of journalists since October the 7th of this year in a grave violation of international laws and norms. Intentional targeting of journalists is considered a war crime and a crime against humanity.
On October 7th, the Israeli regime launched brutal bombardment of the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming tens of thousands of innocent civilians. Palestinian journalists and media workers were no exception. The Israeli regime has so far killed more than 100 Palestinian journalists as well as dozens of their family members. According to Reporters Without Borders, Palestinian journalists have no safe refuge and no way of leaving the blockaded territory.
Every day, Zionist forces target journalists in Gaza, and if they cannot kill them, they kill their family members. The Zionist regime has killed scores of our colleagues along with their families. Tel Aviv wants to silence us and prevent us from exposing Israeli war crimes.
Over the course of the Israeli onslaught, dozens of Gazan journalists have also been reported missing, detained, or injured. Israeli forces have also targeted their media offices and homes.
My message to the international community is that we here, as a journalist, we didn't feel that we are safe. We are targeted, and every time we can be bombed with the Israeli occupation forces. So my message is that we have to be saved. We are doing our work. We are only covering the acts that Israeli made here in the Gaza Strip. So we are trying to get this message to the world.
Experts have dubbed the Israeli aggression since October 7th as the deadliest period for journalists covering military conflicts in more than three decades.
We were displaced from the Tell al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City to the house of our friend, the journalist Adel Zorob, in Rafah. He hosted us for 70 days, and a few days ago, my family was sleeping in the room close to his room, and an Israeli airstrike killed him along with several members of his family and my family.
Reporters Without Borders has described the Gaza Strip as the graveyard of journalists. Journalists in Gaza have been at the forefront of the campaign to expose Israeli crimes against innocent civilians. Experts say Palestinian journalists are paying the price for the international apathy toward Israeli war crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Press TV, Gaza.
The Iraqi government has condemned U.S. strikes on the country's anti-terror popular mobilization units south of the capital, Baghdad. The government said in a statement that such attacks harm relations between the two countries. It said the U.S. strikes killed one Iraqi serviceman and wounded 18 others, including civilians. Earlier, U.S. Central Command confirmed that the strikes hit three facilities belonging to the PMU-affiliated groups in Babylon province. Claimed the move was in response to attacks on American personnel. On Monday, a drone strike from the Iraqi resistance struck a U.S. base in Erbil, leaving three Americans injured. Resistance groups have recently carried out a number of attacks on U.S. facilities in Iraq and neighboring Syria. Anti-U.S. sentiment has grown further since the Israeli regime, backed by Washington, launched its genocidal war on Gaza. David Behrouz is Baghdad bureau chief. He gave us more details about the latest U.S. strikes in Iraq.
Last night, the U.S. carried out the strikes on three facilities used by PMU forces in Babil province, located in southern Iraq. The attacks have left casualties and caused damage to the facilities. The strikes show U.S. adventurism while blatantly violating Iraq's sovereignty. Despite the Iraqi government's warnings to the U.S. against repetition of such attacks, Washington insists on carrying out adventurous moves. Some sources say that the targeted bases belong to Iraq's Hezbollah brigades, a resistance group working under the PMU command. The U.S. claims that the offensives were in response to recent attacks by Iraqi resistance groups on Al-Harir base in Erbil, which had left three American soldiers injured. Resistance groups have underlined that they'll continue their attacks on U.S. facilities in Iraq as long as Israel keeps committing crimes in Gaza and the U.S., as a main accomplice to those crimes, maintains its occupying presence in Iraq. Therefore, in addition to violating the Iraqi sovereignty, the U.S. strikes can lead to the spread of Israel's war on Gaza to elsewhere in the region. At the same time, such U.S. attacks question Washington's claim that it's opposed to any escalation. Not only did they pose serious threats to Iraq's security, but can also spread the war. The U.S. attacks are actually pose serious threats to Iraq and the region as a whole.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is revered in West Asia for its key role in helping the Iraqi and the Syrian armies eliminate the Daesh terror group. Well, now Israel has once again demonstrated its hostility toward the IRGC and the campaign against terrorism by assassinating a senior Iranian military advisor in Syria. Brigadier General Sayed Razi Mousavi was assassinated in a missile strike on a neighborhood near the Sayed Zainab Shrine in Damascus. He was in charge of the resistance front's logistics in Syria. Mousavi was also a comrade of IRGC's late commander, Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone attack near Baghdad International Airport in 2020. The IRGC strongly condemned Mousavi's assassination, saying the occupying Israeli regime will pay for this crime. Iran's president also issued a stern warning to Israel.
Undoubtedly, this malicious move is another sign of the usurping Zionist regime's frustration, helplessness, and weaknesses in the region, and it will certainly pay the price for this crime.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also said that Mousavi bravely fought against terrorists to ensure the security of Iran and the region. Iran's Foreign Ministry also denounced Israel for killing the Iranian military commander. The The ministry's spokesman described the regime's move as cowardly.
Throughout its miserable existence, the Zionist regime has committed all kinds of crimes by repeatedly violating international regulations and norms. This vile and cowardly act is another indication of the terrorist nature of the Zionist regime.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement also reacted. It said the assassination of the Iranian military advisor in Syria adds another crime to the list of atrocities perpetrated by Israel. The resistance movement also described Mousavi's killing as a blatant and shameless attack. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement also slammed the assassination as a cowardly act. Isha Krishnaswamy is a podcaster and journalist. We have talked to her about the U.S. involvement in Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, as well as Washington's regional moves that can lead to the escalation of the war in West Asia.
They know that their war is not going well, so they are trying to draw in more parties into the war, especially U.S., U.K., NATO forces. This would make no sense to needlessly create a tinder for an entire war that can spread to many, many countries. So I think it is intentional on the part of the Israeli forces in order to deepen the commitment and involvement of NATO and especially the U.S. and U.K. forces into more direct aid, in my opinion. This year, there have been 99 attacks against different, like, U.S. Bases or U.S. locations in many countries from many parties. So the U.S. is already feeling vulnerable because they know that they can't actually compete in the economic front when the playing field is even. And so they only have their military front, and that's not going so well. So in that regard, yeah, U.S.'s hegemony is being threatened all over. And so it is going to impact, it is going to want them to reinsert their hegemony, and this seems like a good opportunity for them. So I think they are the Israeli forces are absolutely looking at that fact and taking advantage.
U.S. police have cracked down on pro-Palestinian protesters and arrested several of them as they gathered in New York City again to vent their anger at the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Protesters converged on Midtown Manhattan, chanting slogans like "Christmas is canceled here" and "Long live the Intifada," an Arabic word for the Palestinian uprising. They also carried banners reading "No joy in genocide," and "While you are shopping, bombs are dropping." The protesters also called for an immediate end to the Israeli aggression against Gaza and the occupation of Palestine. Over the weekend, pro-Palestinian rallies were held in several other U.S. cities, including Chicago and Los Angeles. Many of those protests were peaceful. Organizers are using the Christmas holidays to raise more awareness of the Israeli bloodshed on the land where Jesus Christ was born. Pope Francis has brought up the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza in his Christmas Day speech, calling for an end to Israel's killing campaign in the blockaded territory.
I plead for an end to the military operations with their appalling harvest of innocent civilian victims and call for a solution to the desperate humanitarian situation by an opening to the provision of humanitarian aid. May there be an end to the fueling of violence and hatred.
Addressing thousands of people from St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, he pleaded for an end to Israel's killing of the people in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The leader of the Catholic Church also condemned the armaments industry, which he said is motivated by profit and control the puppet strings of war. Pope Francis stated that children dying in wars, including those in Gaza, are the little Jesuses of today. The somber papal address came as Christians in the Palestinian city of Bethlehem have canceled their celebrations in solidarity with the Palestinians under the Israeli onslaught in Gaza. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza. In their fresh attacks, the regime's troopers have raided several areas, including the cities of Al-Khalil and Tulkarem. Two more Palestinians were killed. Earlier, a Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us with more details.
Israeli forces have raided Tulkarem and the refugee camp of Nur Shams in the late hours of Monday, and they just pulled out from the refugee camp and the city of Tulkarem. However, during this military operation, Israeli forces and their bulldozers destroyed infrastructure, Israeli bulldozers, as well, they destroyed two homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp. A number of Palestinians had been wounded during this military operation, and the residents of Nur Shams said that Palestinian fighters exchanged fire with Israeli forces, and they succeeded to detonate a number of Israeli military vehicles. We can say that in the last few weeks, almost on a daily basis, Israeli military, it chooses an area mainly in northern, the occupied West Bank, like Tul Karem, Nablus, and Jenin, and now and Qalqilia as well, and they continue to terrify the people. They destroy the infrastructure, the homes, and the claim, as usual, is to arrest Palestinians, members of the resistance groups, and in order to prevent any Palestinian from being engaged in any form of resistance, mainly the armed resistance.
Palestinian Christians living in Lebanon believe that this Christmas is not a merry one with the continuous onslaught in Gaza. They've canceled this year's celebrations and are mourning their loved ones from afar.
With Christmas celebrations in Al-Quds and Bethlehem canceled, the Christian Palestinians residing in Lebanon also have no reason to be joyous. Mass Christmas services have transformed into prayers of mourning. Nahida and Samar Antoun were killed by Israeli sniper fire in Gaza. Their relatives in the Dbaya refugee camp in Beirut tell Press TV that they were killed as they took refuge in a monastery.
They were killed by Israeli sniper fire, and what we heard from the Pope is not true. It was not by mistake. No one is killed in Gaza by mistake. This is a Zionist policy, and they purposely kill everyone, especially the children and every Arab, no matter what their religion, because we are a thorn in their throat. But we will remain, and they will leave.
They started shelling the churches just like they shelled the mosques. We were first confident that when they go to the church, they will be safe. But sniper fire hit them in the heart of the church. So there is no safe haven in Gaza. We are not celebrating this year just like Al-Quds. We are mourning all of Palestine's martyrs, not only our relatives. Palestinian Christians in Lebanon stress that the Israeli regime does not differentiate between Muslims or Christians, since they are all with the resistance. With tens of thousands already killed by the Israeli regime in Palestine, people at churches in Lebanon remember the oppressed people of Palestine and pray, may Christ be with them. For Palestinian Christians in Lebanon, this Christmas is an occasion to mourn rather than celebrate. As they remember their kin who were martyred in Gaza, their biggest wish of the year is that they may one day celebrate Christmas in their churches as they come back home to a free Palestine. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And that is for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we interview lawyer, activist, human rights advocate, and a leading voice in civic nationalism. He's Secretary of Ireland's Future, an organisation established to promote, debate and discuss the viability of new constitutional arrangements in the event of a united Ireland. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrol. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Niall Murphy. Niall is a leading light in the growing campaign for Irish unity. He also represents many victims in their search for truth and justice with regards to state violence during the conflict. Niall Murphy, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here, Sean. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, before we begin, what motivated your foray into the legal world?
I've always had a sense of what's right and wrong, you know, just as most, you know, people who are reared in houses where that's important. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was at school. Sort of chose law as a default, not knowing what to do. Law was something that you could go on and build and do anything. And as I was studying and just becoming older and a bit more socially mature and understanding, you know, the issues which afflicted society at that time, I went to Queen's from 1985 to 1988. So it was a period of political transition, and your eyes become more acutely aware of life around you. And when I was finished my degree, I applied for a job in Madden and Finucane Solicitors in Castle Street. And I'll never forget it. Last exam, I think it was the 1st of June. The interview was the 2nd of June, and I started on the 3rd of June. And that's been me since.
So Niall, that sense of justice and injustice that you had then obviously inspired you to concentrate on your work on human rights law.
Yes, you know, growing up there was an innate awareness that we were being raised in a society which was institutionally imbalanced, that the enjoyment in life, be it playing Gaelic games or reveling in the culture of our music and our dance and our, obviously our Irish language, and understanding that that wasn't, you know, cherished on a societal basis, and that our practice of our culture was not something that was mainstream. You didn't see it on TV. I can remember BBC began to broadcast the championship, and it was a huge cultural event, you know, because it had never been on TV. And for all of those reasons and many others, when I did get the opportunity to, you know, put a suit on and go into an office every day, the opportunity to engage with people who were at the cutting edge of injustice and to be able to advocate on their behalf very, very quickly, I appreciated the high sense of privilege that it is to represent somebody, to be their advocate, and to make change.
And you then moved on to a lot of bigger cases, and one, not that one case particularly stands out, but one that we both worked on lately was the Armour Road massacre. Mm-hmm. Can you just let the audience know a bit about that, and just the intricacies of what information has come forward lately on that case?
Any case where somebody has lost their life is atrocious. It's the most appalling thing that can happen in the next of kin's life, that they have to endure the loss of their loved one. But in circumstances where it's an atrocity, a multi-death incident, it really resonates from the outset as the seriousness that of what you're dealing with. And in the Omer Road bookmakers shooting, 5 people were killed. From the outset, from before the families even sought legal advice, there was strongly held concerns, which then became evidenced, that the atrocity was planned, permitted, and that the killers were then protected from prosecution. And we engaged with the families on the basis of making a complaint at that time to the police ombudsman. But the thing about the truth is that the truth always comes out, and I do have a comfort in regard that state or non-state illegality can't be suppressed forever. I'm not even talking in about a local context. Anywhere, the truth always comes out. You get the sense sometimes that it's boiling through the pavement. It will come out.
You've been able to carry out that work and to forensically go through the detail of that, but currently the British government are trying to legislate to stop inquests in civil cases. What happens to victims in that scenario then now?
This new legacy bill, which is pending before Parliament, is the most egregious piece of law that has ever been visited upon this island, possibly since the penal times. It is the utter disregard for every citizen resident in this jurisdiction. It is the only political matter which has unified all parties here. There is no support on this island for this bill. Yet it is being rammed through Westminster with abject disregard to the people that it will affect, and it deprives the most vulnerable people in our society of access to justice, of access to the court. Who do they think they are that they can insulate themselves in cases whereby they committed the crime? They are the intended defendant in civil proceedings, for example. What society are we living that it is permissible that a defendant to proceedings can cauterize their own liability and stop those proceedings because they know what they did? In Whitehall, they have the big white wall with the mind map what they did.
Now, Niall, you're a secretary in an organization called Ireland's Future. Can you tell the audience a bit about that organization?
Yes, Ireland's Future is just it's a fantastic initiative that I have had the privilege to be associated with. I act as secretary to the organisation, but the organisation is so many people, thousands of people, in fact. And it's a state of mind, really. Anybody who is concerned about our current constitutional arrangements, the undemocratic nature of that, and has an interest in the future, can associate themselves as being Ireland's Future. It's not the privilege of one set of people or any political party. We're a party political with no allegiance or interest to any formal political party, but we engage with all the political parties who aspire to the reunification of this island. And really our analysis has evolved in live time through the recent Brexit crisis.
You've been very successful in bringing together many inspiring people, a lot of whom are now friends that I've met through the work of Ireland's Future. But how do you see the next decade panning out, Niall? What's your prediction with regards to unity?
Well, I think we're in the decade of change, And sometimes you don't appreciate history when you're living through it. And Brexit is a is an example of that. At the time of Brexit, it was not long after the centenary of the Easter Rising. And had you spoken to any person that was interested in that anniversary, in their heart of hearts, do you think that reunification is on the menu? I think an honest person would have said no. So that was April 2016. By the 16th of June 2016, 2 months later, the constitutional big bang of our century occurred, Brexit, and nobody understood what it meant. It was an ill-defined question which was solely designed to cure infighting in the British Conservative Party, foisted upon an ignorant, with no disrespect, an unsuspecting public who didn't understand what it meant. They were fed lies, jingoism, racism, and the vote went through against the better wishes of the then Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. So we have lived through an experience of how not to do constitutional change. There requires to be planning, preparation, public engagement, scenario planning, empirical evidence. And it's my sincerely held belief that we are already in a decade of change, that the movement towards constitutional change has sort of outgrown the perspectives of different political parties. And it's now, it's on the lips of people in the middle of football that this is the direction of travel. You know, demographics are a crude metric, and I wouldn't, you know, point to them as the sole reason, absolutely not. But it was the basis upon the foundation of this state, and the demographic change which has occurred, and it's never going back. A unionist majority in this jurisdiction is gone now forever and is never, ever, ever coming back. So society has to understand and respond to that fact. And in, you know, when you add in the abuses of this current government, the decade of austerity which has afflicted our public services, the massive economy which is thriving in the south, and when you look at the work of David McWilliams, for example, he points to the fact that pre-partition, Belfast was bigger than Dublin. The north, the northern six counties were a net contributor to the British Exchequer. That stopped in mid-1930s and has never come back. So partition has failed the north. We do not have an economy. We are reliant upon an inflated, reliance on the wider public civil service. And the opportunity to have a newly vibrant entrepreneurial economy that has happened in the south and has reaped the opportunities that their corporation tax returns prove, that hasn't happened in the north. So the opportunity to revitalise Ireland's second city is Belfast. Ireland's second city is not Cork. To revitalise the opportunities that exist for the talent that is just pouring out of our schools and universities. You know, we're one of the most highly educated areas on the planet, but the highly skilled jobs that our young people are entitled to. So it's really about, you know, imagination, but also it's about reality. And the reality is that we need to plan and prepare for constitutional change. And whereas the work that Ireland's Future does, we procure expert evidence, because social discourse should be informed by actual evidence. It shouldn't be informed by lies or emotion.
So just bringing you back to 2020, we're on the other side of a worldwide pandemic, and you had a bit of a scare yourself. Can you tell us a bit about that now?
Yeah, a very, very serious scare. It was the worst time of my life. And for reasons I'll explain, you know, and I now know, emerging, getting better afterwards, that my first 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th of March, I became very, very, very ill, and such to the extent that there was the beginnings of some organ failure, such to the extent that my wife received a phone call to say that she needed to steady herself, that I was sick enough to die, and that I might not make it through that night. That was the 30th of March. And I was completely oblivious to all this. Like, it's just the family were going through all of that whilst locked down. My mother in later months was so agitated about the scandal, about, you know, the lockdown parties at Downing Street and just the egregious abuse, thinking of my wife and my kids locked down, and she couldn't even call over and make her a cup of tea or, you know, help with the dinner or help with the kids. And everybody went through that. But I turned the corner. I began to get better. I did get better. So I was taken out of the coma, and you're weaned off the medication. And just that whole experience of being in a coma, it's not one I would ever recommend, but it is a life experience. Your life completely in the hands, careful, gentle hands of professionals, and you have no say in the matter other than, you know, how your body reacts, and that's a biological thing. And it was life affirming, just coming around and having nurses, and your head is all over the place because you're being weaned off, you know, very heavy medication, sedatives. And when the doctor was putting me under, he said, "You're going to have very vivid dreams," he called them. They were hallucinations. And I did. And I tell you, the experience of that, I could recollect every second of every moment as if it was lifetime. There was one of the days I was convinced that one of the children was out. There's like a garden courtyard, or so I thought there wasn't, but in my mind's eye there was, and that she was just playing in the garden and I was just watching her. So that didn't happen. I was also convinced then that my friend and his wife and my wife were at the bedside, and that my wife and the other wife had decided, "Oh, sure, you're all right now, we'll go out for the night." And sure, you two mind the kids. And I'm obviously hallucinating. Where's the kids? So I apparently, you know, came roundish at about 4 a.m. and tried to get out of the bed, tried to pull all the leads out. And the partners had to, you know, put me down. And I'm, "Where's my children? Where's my children?" And the whole thing was an experience that just gives you so much respect for the medical profession and everybody that works there. As I was coming around, you know, some of the nurses that had looked after me in ICU came into me, and some of them would say, "Oh, my brother plays for Aha and he knows you," or another one says, "I played Camogie for Glenravel," and, you know, just small things that, so there had been social media stuff about me, and there a lot of stuff from the GA, and, you know, just small personal things that really meant so much. And it was just remarkable. And I had never understood, I've aunties that were nurses, I had never understood what a nurse did for a living. I now do. And when I got out of hospital, one of the things that annoyed me so much was this concept which has arisen of clapping on a Thursday night. And I wasn't, so I was contacted to say, "Would you mind if we took a photograph of you and your family out clapping?" And I thought, these people don't need a clap. They need what they're asking for. They need a raise. And I contacted some nurses that had been very good to the family while I was sick, you know, just sort of translating almost the medical speak and where it is actually. And they said, "No, it's something that the profession actually are taking a lot of comfort from, and it is something that we're going to, you know, engage with in terms of our industrial action." So I said, "Right, well, if that's good," then I did, and I did. Went out, and the photographers came up and took a photograph. But that, again, that our nurses, not 3 months beforehand, were required to not be paid for a day's work, to risk the pension threatened entitlements that were threatened against them, for safe staffing, for having enough nurses on a ward. And they were run off their feet. And to have pay parity, not a pay increase, pay parity with other nurses in our so-called wider NHS, it just really aggravated me and agitates me to this day. And that sacrifice that those nurses and doctors made at society's time of need has been forgotten about. and that the Tory government, the criminality of this Tory government enriching their friends in industry in these PPE scandals, billions of pounds that have been spent enriching their cabal, is money that could and should have been spent rewarding the most important people in our society, in my view.
Absolutely, Niall, and every single healthcare worker is a hero.
Yep.
But in spite of your brush with death, it didn't stop you from receiving some pretty nasty and vitriolic attacks along with your colleagues by certain sections of loyalism. Does that affect your work?
Listen, it's irrelevant nonsense. It's social media is not real life as well. And the pomposity that, you know, some people think that their amount of followers lends credence to their opinion. Their opinion's irrelevant. And I don't care. It's completely water off a duck's back. Empty vessels make the most noise. And it's actually laughable. Pathetic. And insofar as that is pathetic, it's immediately disregardable.
Now, it's always good to see you. I want to thank you for coming in today. And we both wish you all the greatest health in the world after the story we've just heard. You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Niall Murphy, a leading light in the movement for a united Ireland. This week, we take a look at the role of the Black and Tans during the Irish War of Independence, who went on to gain a reputation for brutality and became notorious for reprisal attacks on civilians and civilian property, including extrajudicial killings, arson and looting. Their actions further swayed Irish public opinion against British rule and drew condemnation even in Britain.
The Black and Tans were a British force recruited to assist the Royal Irish Constabulary in maintaining control over the IRA during the Irish War of Independence. Many had been ex-British and Irish soldiers signed up to suppress the Irish uprising, with many committing atrocities against Irish citizens. In September 1920, in revenge for the murder of the RIC district inspector and his brother, the Black and Tans sacked the town of Balbriggan. They burned and destroyed homes and businesses and beat two Republicans to death. As was well recognised at the time, the majority of those attacked were victims innocent of any documented complicity. In Gort in December 1920, two local boys with no IRA connections were murdered by the Black and Tans for what they described as impudence. Their bodies were thrown into a ditch after being dragged behind one of the dreaded lorries until they were unrecognisably mangled. This was just one example of what poet W.B. Yeats referred to in his poem Reprisals as half-drunk or whole-mad soldiery. W.B. Yeats' sister Lily wrote to her father John in December 1920 that after witnessing months of Black and Tan atrocities and having seen a lorry load of them pass her house with reprisals galore scrawled on the side, her political stance changed. As you know, I was no Sinn Féiner a year ago, just a made nationalist. But now? In January 2020, the Fine Gael-led Irish government was humiliated into cancelling a commemoration to the RIC after public pressure, along with opposing parties threatening to boycott the event. Despite denying it amounted to a celebration of the infamous Black and Tans, Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan capitulated to calls for the commemoration to be called off. 100 years on, and the mood from the Irish public on the savagery of the Black and Tans has never waned.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Niall Murphy, and my co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, The Conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Rugby English Radio. a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talked about the notion and concept of human being in the Holy Quran. And in the previous episode, we started the discussion about the dimensions, different dimensions of human being in the Holy Quran. And we ended up talking about the soul. First, we talked about a little bit about the human body, and then we talked about the soul or a spirit, a ruh. Now we want to continue the discussion about the soul or an-nafs in the Holy Quran. There are two different words that are used in the Holy Quran. One of them is ruh, spirit. The other is an-nafs, or the soul. And in many verses, we have this word. In some verses, nafs simply means a person, a being, or a living human being. وَكَتَبْنَا فِيهَا أَنَّ النَّفْسَ بِالنَّفْسِ, the human life for a human life, referring to the book of Torah. But there are verses that soul has been used in a general sense, referring to that element or dimension of human being that has different functions. And through these functions, we can understand what this thing is. I don't think we are going to be able to cover everything about the soul in the Holy Quran, but the thing that is related to our discussion, which was the righteous deeds, inshallah we cover. Because we're talking about what originates or what motivates human beings to do the righteous deeds or the vicious deeds, and we said some of these elements are internal. And talking about the internal elements, we should talk about the soul. And there are different layers or different aspects on different stages of the soul that Quran refers to as the soul of human being, for example, commanding. For example, it says, maybe you have heard this, there are three main kinds of the soul. One of them is the commanding soul. One of them is the self-blaming soul. And one of them is settled soul or the peaceful soul. But there are also other things. Maybe one or two more are there. So we go based on the list and we see what are these things and what are the roles that they have in our actions. One of them, in the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, we read this verse, وَمَا أُبَرِّئُ نَفْسِي إِنَّ النَّفْسَ لَأَمَّارَةٌ بِالسُّوءِ إِلَّا مَا رَحِمَ رَبِّي إِنَّ رَبِّي غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. I do not claim that I'm sinless, or I do not claim that my soul does not have that function. What function? إِنَّ النَّفْسَ لَأَمَّارَةٌ بِالسُّوءِ. The soul is commanding to viciousness. لَأَمَّارَة means commanding too much towards, or when something takes you or calls you towards something or command you towards something for too much, it's called لَأَمَّارَة. So in our discussion, I mean in the tradition, Islamic tradition, this has come to be referred to as an-nafs al-ammara, the commanding soul. that if it is not for the help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, illa ma rahim rabbi, if it were not for the mercy and help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you would have fallen victim to this function of the soul calling us towards vicious deeds. Al-amaratu bisu, su means viciousness. And also, there is another verse that we can understand it in this regard, referring to the commanding soul. Inshallah, we cover it after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the concept of soul in the Holy Quran, and we said that one of the layers or aspects or dimensions of the soul, or one of the types of the soul, is commanding soul. And we said one verse is directly referring to that soul. وَمَا أُبَرِّئُ نَفْسِي إِنَّ النَّفْسَ لَأَمَّارَةٌ بِالسُّوءِ. And then there's another verse that says, وَأَمَّا مَنْ خَافَ مَقَامَ رَبِّهِ. Those who fear the position of their Lord, the status of their Lord, not the punishment necessarily. Sometimes it's interesting, between parentheses, to note that sometimes some people fear the punishment, but sometimes some people, they have fear and they have regard. Let's use that word, that could be even better. They have regard for the status and position of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this verse refers to that. وَأَمَّا مَنْ خَافَ مَقَامَ رَبِّهِ. Those who have fear and regard for the position and status of their Lord. وَنَهَا النَّفْسَ عَنِ الْهَوَى. And he abstains his soul from desire. Again, it shows that there has been some tendency from the side of the nafs, the soul, towards desire. And then you have to stop it, you have to control it, you have to contain it. And this could be referring also to an-nafsul ammara, the commanding soul. The soul that commands you to follow your desire to pursue vicious deeds. So that is one part. But it is not all parts of the soul. As you know, as I said earlier in a couple of episodes before, some people in some ideologies, they believe in that original negativity in the human being. But Quran is not like that. Even when we talk about a negative soul, there are different other souls that are good, actually. So one of them, the good souls, is an-nafs al-lawwama, self-blaming souls. وَلَا أُقْسُمُ بِالنَّفْسِ اللَّوَّامَةِ. I swear by the self-blaming soul at the beginning of Surah Al-Qiyamah. So what is self-blaming soul? Self-blaming soul is responsible for making a balance between the commands of the an-nafsul ammara. Then an-nafsul lawama tries to make a balance and stop the human being from falling victim to the commands or following and pursuing all the commands of an-nafs al-ammara. And then it's true that sometimes when the function or the action of this soul becomes more than necessary, a person loses hope in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Self-blaming to the point that the person loses hope in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These two souls, they work together in order to create a balance in a human being, and after a while, the person arrives at the stage that is called an-nafsul mutma'inna. We should talk a little bit more about. And also, there is the an-nafsul musawwila before nafsul mutma'inna. If a person makes it out of all of these three stages, an-nafsul musawwila, an-nafsul ammara, an-nafsul lawwama, then a person arrives at the stage of an-nafsul mutma'inna, about which, inshallah, we talk in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Keep me in your du'as until next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is